commencing countdown. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition.
What an incredible smell, you scum!
Dear Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This ain't happening.
Inconceivable!
Autobots, transform!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode number 14.
Planting apocalyptic prophecies and fortune cookies in order to steal Nostradamus' mojo.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And obviously you see Jen is back.
Yay! Yeah. I got rid of the alien parasites.
Woo. Hooray for us.
Well, yeah. I mean, alien parasites, not exactly fun.
Yeah, well, maybe one of us planted that there on purpose.
You're a bastard.
Anyway, so Jen is back, but this week is actually an uber awesome super duper week.
Yay!
Because we have a very special thing for you at the end of the podcast. Well, not the middle.
At the beginning? What? The end? Really? No. Okay.
It's technically the last 90% of the show. So
no, it's the middle.
Whatever. Anyway, it's awesome. It's the greatest thing in the history of the world. I will defend that claim gladiator style if anyone wants to go. And by that I mean like TV, the gladiator with like the giant Q-tips, like, because I don't want to kill anybody because that's ridiculous. But
sadly, Sean here will probably still lose, but he'll defend it anyway.
It's best out of seven. Unless I deem it no more. Anyway, yeah. So today we actually have an interview with Jason Sanford, which will come right after our very quick news segment. And then at the end, we'll have, obviously, just really quick, the question of the week, ways to contact us, and then we're gone. There's no reading or writing segment this episode, just because we don't want this to be a 9,000-hour podcast, when really the center of the show is Jason Sanford, who was very kind to join us on the show that we recorded technically before we recorded this. So
speaking in past and future tense.
Yeah, so much for getting that right. Anyway, so there's two big things that are going on. The first one is on Grasping for the Wind, Philip at Athens, I think that's how you say his last name, is proposing that September 7th should be National Buy a Book Day. And it's in response to sort of the borders is like having bankruptcy problems, and obviously all of the bookstores are having issues. So the idea is on September 7th, everyone go out to an actual physical bookstore. Doesn't matter what kind of bookstore it is. It can be anyone. It can be for pregnancy books if you want, sure. And buy a book from a bookstore. That's it.
A full price book from a bookstore.
Oh, is it a full price book? Does it say that?
Yes, a full price, not one that's on sale. A full price book from a bookstore in order to support the publishing industry, and particularly physical bookstores.
Well, I think that helps the bookstores more than it helps the publishers, because the publishers still get the royalties.
Oh, well, yeah, technically. So, yes, it's just the bookstores. Yeah. You're helping bookstores.
So you're mostly helping bookstores, which, let's face it, guys, like, even though it's easier to get books off the interwebs, we still want bookstores, because if you're a book person, you want to hold a book before you buy it. So
you do?
I do. I love this.
I like to browse, and browsing is best done.
I like the smell of books.
And yes, agreed.
Yeah.
But if you don't need a book for yourself, that brings us to our next announcement. The NATO forces in Kabul, Afghanistan, have a library, and they need donations of books. So if you'd like, you can buy a book on National Book Buying Day and then send it to our wonderful troops overseas.
Yeah, and my understanding is that because it's going to a military base, the shipping's cheaper.
Yes, it is.
I don't know how much it is. I don't know if it's just regular U.S. rate, like domestic, or what. Maybe you know, Jen, because your husband was former military.
Yeah, I believe it is considered a in U.S. Shipping rate. I'm not positive, honestly. He never got, you know, posted overseas or anything. So okay. I will find out soon, though, because I'm going to be sending packages soon.
Yeah, and I am too. In October, they have a major book sale. Not a major, but it's like a used book sale for the, to support the libraries in this county that I live in, the Alachua County. And I'm actually going to go there, and I'm going to try to buy a box of books of varied stuff.
And send it over.
And send it overseas. And the good thing is I'm literally helping two people there. I'm helping the libraries and helping the troops, which, I mean, I love both.
Yeah, totally agreed.
But anyway, so you could do that, and that would be great. So you're doing cool, awesome things, doing National Book Day, and sending books to the troops, which is awesome. So
indeed.
That's it for our intro. We're not going to talk about news too much this week because we want to actually go to the interview with Jason Sanford. So that's literally what we're going to do. Right after the music, we're going to start up with Jason Sanford.
Very exciting.
It's very exciting. All right, we'll be right back. And we're back, and we have with us today Jason Sanford. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Hey, glad to be here.
Very excited.
Thanks for interrupting me, Jen. Good job.
Sorry, we aren't talking yet.
All right, well, I thought we would start off, since you are mostly a short story author, we would start about your thoughts on the short story market, specifically the science fiction and fantasy field, like what you feel about the status of that field, since there's all this hubbub about the death of the short fiction market and yada yada. So since you actually write the stuff and you publish it regularly, I wanted to get your thoughts on all of the hubbub.
Well, I mean, you know, to be honest, I think the short fiction market is doing better than ever. Now, the caveat is, do you want to make a living writing short fiction? It ain't going to happen. And that's probably what a lot of people are complaining about, especially writers. I mean, you go back into the glory days of science fiction and, you know, you had a decent shot at making a living. You know, Harlan Ellison, a great example of someone who could make a living mainly doing short story writing, although he eventually had to sell his soul to Hollywood to survive. But, you know, so there are a lot of short fiction markets. There's probably more short fiction markets now than there were, you know, a decade ago. But, you know, how many of them are paid professional rates? How many of them can you actually, you know, make a decent amount of money for your story for? Not that many. So
why do you think that is?
Well, people have trouble selling it. I mean, you know, there's just really not that big a market for short fiction. Now, I'm an optimist. I think it's going to change. I think the Kindle and ebook readers and other reading devices are going to change the ability of people to buy short fiction. Right. You know, right now it's hard for you to go out and pick up a science fiction magazine. I mean, I go to Barnes & Noble and it's lucky if they have a copy or two of Asimov's and Analog in there, you know, but if you have a Kindle, you can, you know, it's getting where you can download more science fiction magazines from the, you know, the sofa in your house than you can from a big bookstore.
Right. And the short stories are really, they seem to be tailor-made for our fast-paced lives. So.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and one reason I think that short fiction will do well in the coming years is podcasts have done so well with iPhones and everything like that. People love it. I mean, you know, hey, I can listen to a short story, 30 minutes. Hey, that's my commute or that's such and such. And not a problem. So I think, you know, I think it'll turn around.
Excellent.
I could be totally wrong and it dies in 3 years. Who knows?
Well, I hope so for your sake and Duke's here. Because
I'm trying to do the same thing. You know, James for Sanford has done more successfully, which is the short fiction track. But it is interesting because when you look in the U.S. market and then you compare it to China's market, even when you compare the population differences, China's two biggest science fiction magazines are like three or four times bigger than even the biggest one here. And it's really interesting to see that they're so much more interested in the short fiction, at least immediately at this moment, than we seem to be at the moment now here in the States and in the UK.
Hmm.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the biggest science fiction magazines in the world are all based in China right now. You know, and I have heard that the and this may not be the total truth, but I've heard from several sources that the readership of the science fiction magazines in China is also very young. Mm-hmm. Which, if you look at the readership of the science fiction magazines in the United States, they skew older. So, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot of differences, you know, and part of that's cultural. You know, China's been going through a lot of development the last 20 years. And, you know, so I guess, you know, in many ways, you know, science fiction short stories are a new thing there. So they're very popular.
It seems like to an extent they're at the point that we were, you know, say 50 years ago, when the short story and pulp was as popular as it was developmentally 100 years ago, whatever. No, not really. I mean, you had a pretty popular market when my dad was growing up in terms of short stories.
That's true.
And in terms of industrial development, they're at a similar place.
And actually, what I understand is there's a similar attitude towards science fiction in China that there was in the United States back in the 50s. Here in the United States then,
right.
Science fiction was seen as a way to educate people about science. You know, so there was a kind of a de facto, hey, this is a good thing to read. You know, get kids reading science fiction. As they read more science fiction, they'll understand more science, and we'll close that pesky missile gap, and we'll catch up to Sputnik and all that kind of stuff. Well,
right.
The Chinese government has a similar attitude towards science fiction magazines. They don't run them, but they, you know, obviously there's encouragement to them.
Right.
And, you know, so there's differences, and, you know, but still, I think science fiction, not only short fiction, but novel length fiction has been kind of in the doldrums in the United States for the last 20 years or so. And I think it's really primed for a comeback.
I hope so.
Well, it seems like the difference of what you had mentioned earlier, and this is something a lot of people have pointed out when they did the running the numbers in the big three science fiction and fantasy magazines, which is that in the U.S., you know, as you said, that our audience for short fiction tends to be the older audience. And in China, as you were saying, they seem to be more the younger audience. So I wonder how would we even go about trying to bring in more of the younger audience? Because the younger audience seems so much more interested in the movies, which, to be fair, there's a lot of great science fiction movies in the last few years that have come out. And trying to bring them back to short fiction, it seems that's a very daunting task, because that would be what would make, I think, the short fiction market for genre really powerful, is to have that younger audience again.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's not just a short fiction. I mean, science fiction as a genre has a problem with bringing in young people as readers. You know, I actually wrote a review of a young adult novel not too long ago where I said, hey, it's not great science fiction, but this is a novel which can appeal to young people and bring in new readers. And that's something good that that the genre has overlooked, be it short fiction or a novel-length fiction or anything. And, you know, if you go out, there's plenty of entry-level fantasy out there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in fact, there's too much entry-level fantasy. But,
agreed.
You know, but that's a good thing. I mean, that's a good thing for the fantasy genre. For some reason, science fiction hasn't happened. You know, what you get are, you know, short stories and longer fiction in science, which is very written for insiders. You have to kind of already understand the genre to make sense of the story. And that's not something that a young person is going to just, hey, let me get right into this.
Right. It's very true. I mean, my kids, I've got an 8 and a 9-year-old girls, and they're definitely in the fantasy phase. And, you know, I, as hard as I try to find them science fiction to get them interested in it, I still just haven't found much, particularly in the libraries. There just isn't a lot out there, except for Ray Bradbury, for instance, you know, is about the level of reading that they're at. But, you know, that's 50 years old, 60 years old. So,
exactly.
You know, it's tough finding contemporary science fiction for kids of that age or slightly older. So
exactly. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the classics. I love classic science fiction.
Right.
And that's what brought me into the genre.
Exactly.
But, you know, the kids need new science fiction at their level. Now, the book I was talking about is I Am Number 4. And it was I enjoyed reading it. But my son, he loved it. He's 11. He just went crazy for this book. He loves it, wants to read the next one. That's exactly the kind of reaction you want someone to have to science fiction. And my son actually reads a lot of fantasy, but one of his he doesn't like Harry Potter, and one of his complaints is that a lot of the fantasy is just boring. So I think he would, if there was more young adult science fiction, he would react well to it.
It's interesting, and I'm planning on picking the book up for my girls. Hopefully they'll like it too.
Yeah, and it's going to be a movie now. They're
in the middle of it. I mean, you know, don't get me going about, you know, the novel is primed for success. You know, it's, you know, Spielberg and Bay and all of them are, you know, just going to make a massive movie about it, you know, but that doesn't appeal to me. But like I said, my son enjoyed the novel, so that's what mattered.
Where were we next,
Dude? Well, I thought actually, since we're still talking about the short story market, because I know you have in the past written about the sort of literary magazines in relation to the genre magazines, and I actually thought we would pry your thoughts on that again, because you've kind of, I think, like recently you talked about Tin House and their really bizarre policy, and you've said some other things about literary magazines that have just seemed completely out of touch with, and how just literary short fiction is kind of, I guess, not really gone anywhere, whereas it seems like genre fiction has, in a way at least, kind of grabbed the online market fairly well. So I thought I would really like to know your thoughts on that again.
Oh, of course. And you know, I should, everything I said before about genre short fiction, I mean, it's doing great compared to literary short fiction. I mean, let's put that right out there. I mean, there are readers of genre short fiction who are not writers, but there are very few readers of literary short fiction who are not writers. I mean, basically, literary short fiction is, you know, you've got writers reading other writers and support, you know, who reads the literary magazines except other writers. I mean, you have a few academics and a few others, but I mean, you know, at least genre science fiction and fantasy and horror, you know, those magazines have people who are not writers reading them, you know, so that's a good point. Now, yes, I mean, you know, so the literary magazines, I really think they're in trouble. You know, not many of them have embraced electronic publishing. They still put, you know, I mean, it's been how long since, you know, online magazines have been around, and you still have these, you know, small press magazines that publish 500 or 1,000 copies a quarter. And, you know, a decent online magazine will have that, will get 1,000 readers every day or two at the most. So, you know, it's, I don't know if it'll change. I really don't. I mean, there are some places that, you know, some good online literary magazines now, I mean, literary magazines that went online or went to ebooks and everything like that, but they're very few. And the situation with Tin House, what happened there is basically Tin House said that unless a writer can send them a receipt where they actually went and bought a book, they wouldn't consider their submissions, which, one, you know, that's basically saying, you know, hey, you know, no one's reading our stuff, so we have to force you, almost bribe you, you know, to go out and buy stuff, which, I mean, that's just a bad attitude. I mean, you know, you want people reading your stuff, reading your fiction, your poetry and everything. And if you can't get the readership, you're dead. It's that simple.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder how much of that is tied in with the fact that so many literary magazines and journals are based at universities. And so since university academic speaking, since I do academic work or try to, we'll see how that goes. They have been very slow with sort of the essay world of getting into the electronic market. It's starting to change, but it's really, really slow. And I wonder if that, maybe that's tied into that, is that because they're tied with universities, there's that sort of like the belief that somehow online fiction's just not, it's not as valuable or as prestigious or whatever. I would think so, but I don't know.
Well, I mean, I mean, as you can attest, the academic world has its own mindset. You know, it's very insulated. You know, it's very inwardly focused. You know, so yeah, I mean, part of it is, you know, my little literary journal, which has 500 copies printed, is obviously better than some crappy little online magazine that, you know, tens of thousands of people read, you know. So, you know, part of it's attitude. Part of it is, but it's also part of it is a lot of the literary journals, they don't have to go out and seek readership. They are supported by the universities, whether or not people subscribe, whether or not people read the magazine. I mean, you go, I mean, say what you will about genre magazines. If Asimov's doesn't have subscribers and readers, they will go under. It's same for all the professional science fiction, fantasy, and horror magazines. They have to have a readership or they will not exist. You know, if you're kumquat, you know, review at some, you know, rinky dink university, you don't have to have a readership, you know, because your bills are paid. You know,
things that are safe are slow to adapt, you know.
Exactly. They're very safe. They don't have to risk anything, you know. So, but unfortunately, that means that one day they're going to wake up and be, and they've been so, left so far behind, they're irrelevant.
Right.
Which I think they're almost at that point now, at least a lot of them, not all of them, but.
Oh, exactly. Now, that's what, I guess that was my issue with Ten House, is that was, I mean, Ten House is, it's a good literary journal for what it is. You know, it's very, again, insulated, insider, that whole thing. And the funny thing is they're saying, we'll consider your submissions if you send us that receipt. I did some digging. They have, you know how long it's been since they pulled a submission and accepted it out of the slush pile? It's like years. So it doesn't happen. So it's like, you know what? Send them your submission. Send them your receipt. It's not going to happen, you know, but, you know, that's just doing that kind of thing is just screaming that you're irrelevant to the current literary world.
Yeah, and it's completely ridiculous. I think Adam and I talked about this very issue, and my thing was like, so I'm going to spend money to buy a book, which I might have bought anyway, to send a story to a place that's going to reject it.
Right. And worse, and what really got me is it wasn't just you had to have a receipt. You had to have a receipt from a physical bookstore. You couldn't, I mean, but most Americans now are buying their books from Amazon and other places like that, or they're downloading books to their Kindle, to their ebook readers. None of that, to Ten House, none of that counted. None of that was a legitimate book purchase. It had to be from, you had to go to an independent bookseller and buy a book. Well, you know, I hate to say, I live in a pretty big city here, and, you know, there's really not that many even independent booksellers here. There's a few, but it's like, you know, when I go in, I'm like, okay, they don't have the books I want. So I, you know, sometimes I can get them, sometimes I can't, you know, so I had to end up, some of them I order from Amazon, some I order, you know, from other places, you know, you go where you can to get the books you want.
Yeah, I agree. And it's very silly because some places in the country don't even have bookstores.
I'm not sure if my new town has a bookstore, to be honest, but we have a library, so.
Exactly. And well, that's another thing too. It overlooks libraries, that Ten House thing. Totally forgot about libraries, which is where I live. I have two great library systems where I live, and I use the libraries all the time. Where I grew up in Alabama, there were no libraries essentially. And I had to go, you know, bookstores were quite a distance away. There surely were no independent bookstores that I could hit. So I would go to the chain bookstores and look at the paperbacks. You know, that's the way how I got my education on books, except, you know, luckily my grandfather had a ton of science fiction and fantasy books that he'd been collecting for decades. So
that's amazing in itself.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Good luck.
So why don't we move on to... since we've been talking about short stories of everybody else, how do you approach writing your own short stories?
Usually I have an idea, a character, and the opening of the story of a short story in my mind, and I go from there. When I work on longer length fiction, I tend to plot it out and all that. But be honest, with my short fiction, I tend to see it more of as an experiment. You know, so I have the characters, I kind of put them in and I push them through and see what happens, you know. But like I said, I usually at least have an idea of what I want to happen. I have the voice of the story in my mind, and I have some strong characters.
Do you feel like in a sense there's more freedom in writing short stories than there is in writing longer novels, for instance?
Oh, absolutely. I think short stories are much purer form of storytelling than novel-length fiction. I mean, I love novels, but so many of them, the story could have been much tighter, if you know what I mean. It had to be stretched to reach that length. It had to be pulled apart. It had to be had all this extraneous material put in. So, yeah, I love it. I mean, my favorite type of storytelling is short stories. Again, I'm working on novels right now, you know, and sometimes, you know, some stories I'm working on, you know, are kind of, you know, build upon each other. So you have a series of stories that maybe that'll eventually, you know, be a novel. But I do love short stories.
Now you kind of indicated that you sort of have an organic process where you kind of have an idea and you kind of throw the characters in and kind of see what happens. So do your characters sometimes surprise you? Like, they do things that you just did not expect that they were going to do and suddenly have a totally different thing than you intended?
Oh, I would say yes and no. I've heard that from many authors. Like, wow, I had no idea the character was going to do that until it did it. Well, I mean, yeah, I'm writing the character, so I know what it's about to do because, you know, but the characters in the plot and the situation and the plot of the story do take me in ways I could not have told you an hour before. But as I'm writing it, the path becomes self-evident. So it doesn't surprise me. But like I said, if you'd asked me before I started writing it, if this was going to happen, I couldn't have told you. But, you know, the process, the organic, as you said, process of writing the story, it takes you in a certain way. And then you're like, oh, of course, this has to happen.
Totally. I'm sorry. That makes complete sense to me. I've always kind of rejected the idea that, you know, things surprise authors. It just doesn't make sense.
Surprise me, but...
Well, that's because you're insane. And the other voices in your head that are doing it for you. So I was kind of curious because Sean is the one that's the big short story fan. I'm primarily a novel reader. But when I was a kid, Ray Bradbury was probably my favorite science fiction author. He was what introduced me to the genre to a large extent. And as I was reading through the stories that you have available on your website, some of them to me felt very Ray Bradbury-ish in that they're very real situations that feel incredibly natural, even though they're these, you know, slightly crazy science fiction concepts. Do you see any similarities there with your, I mean, is it just me?
Well, I love Ray Bradbury. And, you know, I mean, I got to be honest, I'm sitting here grinning going, hey, if someone was to compare my stories to Ray Bradbury, I'm totally good with that.
All right, good.
For what it's worth, you're not the only one who has said that. When Interzone accepted my first story, they sent me the comments from the reviewers, and one of them said, wow, this is just like Ray Bradbury. And that made my day then, too. So, you know, now, is that something I'm trying for? No. But right. I did when I was growing up, I love and I still do. I loved Ray Bradbury's stories. Right. And, you know, so, I mean, I can think of no better thing to aim for as a science fiction writer than to write as good as Ray Bradbury did and does.
No, for sure.
He's about to turn. He just turned 90.
So I know. Yeah. Crazy. And still at Comic-Con. So,
yeah,
we can only hope for that. Virile.
Well, he had some very unkind words about ebooks and
oh yes,
yeah, wow. Which I thought was really funny. He was just like, I don't need that. I make $1 billion off Fahrenheit 451, so I don't need your stupid ebooks.
Well, and he's entitled. I mean, there's, you know, and I think anyone who's going to try to criticize him for that, I mean, the truth is he's entitled to that. I mean, when you reach that point in your life, you don't have to be you should not be forced to try new things if you don't want to, you know. Now that sure. Now part of me is like, I hope when I'm 90 years old that I'm still, you know, if they have some machine to download stories straight into your head, I give it a try once or twice, you know. But you know, that's everybody wants to try things different way. But yeah, I saw that comment from him. I was like, well, hey, you know, I'd say what he earned it, and I'm not going to criticize.
For sure. And my other question, as a slight Southerner, is I noticed in, you know, a couple of your stories, for sure, it seemed that the South really does influence your writing, particularly the environment, but certainly the culture to an extent. So how much do you think that your roots influence your writing? And in what ways do you think it does so most clearly?
Well, my roots absolutely influence my writing. But, you know, the caveat to that is everything I've done in my life influences my writing. But yes, right. You can definitely see the South in a lot of what I write. Not everything.
No, right.
In fact, I just sold a story to Orson Scott Card's Intergalactic Medicine Show.
Oh,
and that one is set in Apalachicola, Florida. And it's probably the most Southern science fiction / fantasy story I've ever written. But there's others. Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I mean, for a long time, I edited a Southern literary journal called Story South. And so it's all in it. Part of it is growing up in the South, the culture and the environment and the people are very storytelling worthy, I guess you could say. I mean, they really,
right.
stories are such a big part of the South, and the culture and the environment and the people of the South are just so tied in with stories. I mean, you can't not write about it, you know, but also part of it's just, it's what I know. I mean, you know, growing up in the pine forest and the cotton fields down in Alabama, you know, and just, you know, I know what it feels like to, you know, work outside doing archaeology when it's 100 degrees and a heat index of 120, you know, and, you know, so that stuff's naturally going to work its way into my fiction.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to avoid in the South, I suppose.
Oh, exactly.
The environment, you know, it's.
Yes, but don't, I mean, do understand, I mean, most of my stories are not set in the South.
No, I noticed that it was more a feel of the environment, was even though if it wasn't specifically something, you know, this is in the South, there was still, you could feel the kudzu, so to speak, in some of the stories.
I'm not trying to pick kudzu. You mean kudzu?
Kudzu. I'm sorry. I can't pronounce it. Isn't it kudzu?
It's kudzu.
All right.
Just picking.
That's funny. It's just the organic matter of the environment in the South.
And the South is changing a lot. I mean, you know,
right.
And I was born and raised after the Civil Rights Movement. The South has changed even a lot in my lifetime. Every time I go down back to the South to visit now, it has changed. So, you know, there is no one South anymore. I mean, and
right.
There never was, to be honest.
No.
You know, so it's a wonderful, fascinating place. You know, and I think people are going to be writing stories about it for, you know, another couple of hundred years.
Definitely.
I'm sure they
will. Yeah, I'm actually new to the South, so I've only been here a year. Although I don't know if you can consider Gainesville really the South. It's like a bizarre college town. It's, no.
I mean, I've heard a lot of theories on that, on whether or not Florida counts anymore as the South. To me, yeah, it counts. You know, I mean, if it gets over 100 degrees where you live, yeah I'm going to call it South.
With 100% humidity, you know.
Oh, yeah. Can't forget the humidity.
Yeah, all right.
Well, this actually, because you kind of went, you already mentioned that you did the story South, and then you'd. Something you'd mentioned that actually made me think of this sci-fi strange thing, which you decided to be sneaky and posted a anthology or an online, what you would make as an anthology of stories for this whole thing you're calling sci-fi strange, in which I think Hartwell from the which anthology, the Year's Best SF, number 14 or 15?
14, yes.
14, that had your story, Ships Like Clouds, Risen by Their Rain, which is an awesome story and everyone should read it. So I actually wanted to ask, because you've talked a bit about it on your blog, but maybe you could be more specific, what the heck is sci-fi strange?
Well, you know, I see it, you know, basically, I mean, when people think of science fiction, they think of, you know, basically the golden age of science fiction. You know, they don't. Yes, we've had the new wave movement. We've had all this, you know, cyberpunk and everything like that. But when you say science fiction, people think of ray guns and spaceships and all that. And I guess, but to me, what was really resonating there is that sense of wonder that came from the golden age of science fiction. Well, to me, what I'm seeing is a lot of stories, science fiction stories now, that are combining that sense of wonder from the golden age of science fiction with, you know, very high literary standards and the cultural understandings and the experimentation of the new wave movement. So it's kind of pulling all of that together into a science fiction that is beautifully written and is also, you know, it blows you away with the, wow, this is amazing. And it's also exploring basically stuff that is on the science of today that is almost like philosophy. You know, if you go, I mean, the science that quantum mechanics and all of that jazz is, you know, you try to describe it to people and it's like, are you kidding me? It sounds like it's just a bunch of hooey, but, you know, basically this is science fiction that is going to the very edge of what is possible. And, you know, so it is still part of the quote literature of ideas that has always been the hallmark of science fiction, but it's got a real sense of being philosophical. It's got a real sense of, hey, we're pushing the boundaries of what you can do and understand and accept as something that could happen. Because to me, the difference between science fiction and fantasy is that science fiction deals with stories that could happen, probably won't happen. Maybe you don't ever want it to happen. But science fiction is within the realm of possibility in our reality. Fantasy is something that absolutely could not happen, even though we really wish it would. You know, hey, I'd love to have dragons and elves and all that in our world, but it's just not going to happen. Unless you can pull in some science fiction and, you know, start, you know, geneing people to, you know, have pointy ears and all that kind of stuff.
I was just thinking that. It's like, all we need is somebody to, you know, reverse engineer a lizard and give it wings.
Oh, exactly. You know, and I guess, you know, so I guess that's what the sci-fi strange is it brings in the sense of wonder of the old science fiction with the great writing of the new wave movement. And it's got the multicultural and, you know, cultural understandings of the world today. And ties all that in with just, you know, mind-blowing, you know, explorations of life.
At what point, though, does, you know, that the philosophical nature of science that is so far out there that you can practically not even grasp it, at what point does that become fantasy?
Well, and that's the question. I mean, you know, and that's one thing I think a lot of people have with this type of science fiction is they're like, okay, that's not science fiction. That is fantasy. Right. For example, there was a great story published earlier this year in Asimov's called Stonewall Truth by Carolyn Yochim. And it's a wonderful science fiction story. It's about this far future time where the remnant of a technological artifact from the past is in this village. It's a wall, except this wall has the ability that if you put someone up against it and cut them to pieces, they, one, won't die. And two, the wall will force them to really look at themselves at all the evil and bad things they've done in life and really see it. And then you can stitch the person back up, you know, after basically cutting them wide open, and they'll live. But now they're having to live with this knowledge that the wall forced on them. Now, how that happens, the technology of how that wall does that is not explained. But the story is pure science fiction because it is, you know, it's dealing with, hey, you know, technology, you know, who knows what it's going to be like a couple hundred years from now or a thousand years from now. So the story is within the realm of possibility. Now, some critics said, hey, that story is a masterpiece, but it's fantasy. I disagree because, again, to my mind, that story could happen. It's probably not. I mean, let's be honest. No, it's not going to happen probably, but it's within the realm of the way, you know, our society develops in the coming decades and centuries. Hey, something like this could happen. You know, fantasy to me is not going to ever happen. You know, something like Harry Potter, there is a fun read, but you know, that kind of magic is not going to happen. So that, to me, that's the difference. But there is a lot of people who say, you know, this type of science fiction that pushes the boundaries of what is possible, they say, hey, this is not science fiction, it's fantasy.
Right. You mentioned, you know, the Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun. And the second you mentioned that book, I really got what you meant by sci-fi strange, really. Or at least the mixing of, you know, is it fantasy, is it fiction? Because I remember reading it and just going, being convinced that the first book was fantasy until right. about halfway through. And then I was like, oh, of course it's science fiction. And, you know, went on from there. And it definitely shifted my understanding of what was going on in the novel. So, and then Ray Bradbury, I remember being a child and thinking that, you know, half of what he was talking about, especially with limited understanding of science at the age of, you know, 8 or 9, thinking that he was talking about magical things.
Exactly.
It wasn't until later on that I realized it was all science and technology. So.
Oh, exactly. I mean, Gene Wolfe's The Book of the New Sun, I mean, that's the perfect example. And to me, it has very much that feel of science, sci-fi strange. Right. I love that series. It's amazing. And I think one thing is that because he is more vague on how some of the technology in that happens, that it creates a more believable future.
Right.
More believable possibilities. You know, I love hard science fiction, and I do, and some of what I write is hard science fiction. But I love Arthur C. Clarke's works. But when you're that specific on the science, you are, in some ways, you're limiting yourself to what is possible at that one moment in time. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to go into the future with your story and trying to forecast and play with our future dreams of what could happen, you don't want to limit yourself. So, you know, that's why, you know, I think there's a need for all types of science fiction. I think it's all valid, you know, it's just, you know, but don't dismiss something just because it doesn't have something that could happen at this one moment in time and with our technology as it exists on this day in 2010.
Right. I think you, at that point, lose that sense of wonder.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And that's another reason I think that this new type of this science fiction I'm talking about is such a big deal, is that that is one thing that science fiction has lost, is the sense of wonder, because as our technology and our society has developed, as we've gone to doing an interview over the internet by Skype, it's lost the ability of people have lost the ability to be amazed by science fiction. You know, so I think, you know, all those stories I put together into that online anthology, one common thread is that they all excited me and amazed me, you know, and that's a big deal.
And what you've been saying here, it now sort of makes it clear to me, I think, how sci-fi strange is tied to the New Weird movement, but also separate from it, because I think New Weird, it takes that sort of, or at least most New Weird, goes kind of in the more fantasy direction, but then it brings in a lot of sciencey kind of stuff, like particularly like Perdido Street Station, where a lot of it is there are things, like, well, one of the main characters is he's a scientist, and there's all this stuff that's kind of scientific-y, but it's pseudo-scientific-y, it's not sure, like, is it real science, is it fake science, I don't really know, whereas what you're saying with Sci-Fi Strange is it's sort of taking science now, but then just dragging it all the way to the edge of what we think is possible, at least now, maybe in 1,000 years, what would be sci-fi strange would be completely incomprehensible to us now because it would be so out there, you know. But yeah, and it's very interesting that connection.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you know, and that's why, you know, I think the new weird and this sci-fi strange are related, as you said, but they are very different, and they have, you know, they're trying to accomplish different things. And, you know, and most importantly, I think readers like myself react to them totally differently. You know, I read a sci-fi strange story and I'm just like, I mean, wow, that dazzled. I mean, that's just unbelievable. When I read a lot of the new weird, I love this. I love the writing. I love the stories, but it's not like it opened me to new possibilities for humanity and new possibilities for the future. I think it's a different reaction. I mean, they're both, you know, both very valid, but they're just different.
And how do you then, because I know you mentioned that sci-fi strange for you has this kind of higher literary standard, at least of maybe more typical science fiction.
Right.
And obviously New Weird is very much tied into that real high literary, but more in the experimental textual sense.
Right.
So what for you then defines quote-unquote literary? Because I guess we all have arguments about what literary is, but I'm curious what you think literary is.
Oh, exactly. And in fact, it's funny because Jeff Vandermeer got on me about this same thing about, you know, when I was talking about Sci-Fi Strange, first talking about it. And, you know, so we went back and forth on it. But, you know, in some ways, trying to say what is literary and what is not, I mean, it's a false distinction. I'm not a big fan of saying, hey, this is literary fiction, this is genre fiction. I mean, you get down to it, you have well-written stories and you have poorly written stories. You have stories that try to be more than just a simple telling of the story. And you have stories that just, you know, very simple. Hey, here's what happened. Here's how it went. All those stories can be great. But to me, when people say literary, I think what they're really trying to say is this is a story that the writing is beautiful. Great stories are what matter. Great writing is what matters. It doesn't matter if you call it literary, genre, you know, horror, whatever you want to call it. What matters is that you have great characters, great stories, great writing, that stuff that makes you want to just, hey, this story is going to live for decades. This is a story I want to tell to my kids, my grandkids. I want people to read this story. To me, that's what you try to go for. And when someone says literary, that's what they're really meaning, is this is a story that can make a difference that matters to people.
I like that a lot better than the other definitions of literary. That one's much more entertaining.
Well, I try.
Actually, I want to know, since I'm subscribed to Interzone, and they regularly publish you, but you said you had a story coming out in IGMS. What other stuff have you got, like, in the pipeline in terms of your short fiction? And then obviously you mentioned you're working on a novel, so
yes,
I want to know about that too. So,
okay, well, like I said, I just had a story accepted by IGMS. It'll probably be out at the end of this year. It's called The Never Never Wizard of Apalachicola. And it's actually a combination of science fiction and fantasy. I've got an astronaut working on the space station who gets drawn into discovering the real nature of the world. I'll leave it at that. I have another story that's coming out in Interzone sometime in the near future called Millicent Kaw Plays in Real Time. That one is a pure science fiction. Actually got a kind of interesting, I'm not going to mention it, but it's got an interesting way that monetary system that's tied in with it, and which I think people will be like, oh, that's pretty cool. But it's actually, I think it's I love that story, and I've been trying to get it out for a while, so I'm excited they took it. And now I just finished another story, which is a sequel to my Plague Birds, which came out in issue 228 of Interzone back in May of this year. So I just finished the sequel to that story, and that one I'm actually got some people send it to a workshop I take part in. So I'm getting some feedback on it. Then I'll submit it. That one's going to go to Interzone. So if they want it, hopefully it'll be out. If not, I'll shop it around.
Excellent.
And what about your novel?
Well, that's kind of
top secret.
It's kind of top secret. Now, I will say I'm actually working on two novels. One of them is an expansion of the story that started in Sublimation Angels, which is a novella I wrote that came out in Interzone last year.
And was nominated for Nebula.
Yes, it was. It was a finalist for the Nebula Award for Best Novella. I was thrilled about that. The story is, there's more to the story there. And I'm not. One thing that's always drives me crazy about authors is when they publish a great story and they say, hey, let me expand the story into novel length. So they stretch out the story. Well, I'm not doing that. That novella is like the first 20,000 words of the novel, and it just goes from there, essentially. You know, I will have to make some, you know, tweaks here and there, obviously. But That's my next project, but right now I've been working on it too right now, but mainly I've been focused on it. I hate to say it, it's more of a mystery novel. Oh. So
I'm not against mystery.
Oh, good. Just didn't want to put that M word out there during the interview. I was like, but
wrong show. No.
No, but I'm working on that right now. Although I do want to say it's a mystery. It's not your standard mystery, and it's actually set in the South, along the Gulf Coast, and the stuff it deals with, it actually feels more like a science fiction novel. Happens to be set in the present. And is dealing with actually oil spills and other stuff. Go figure. That's what happens. You start trying to write a novel set in the present day, set along the Gulf Coast, and something happens, like BP comes along, and then you're like, well, shoot, I guess I'm gonna have to bring this in. But it's going well. I'm about a third of the way done with it, and I hope to finish up the first draft of that in the next 2 months.
Wow.
Then I'm gonna jump back into Sublimation Angels.
Well, that's very exciting.
I for one am looking forward to more Sublimation Angels. I really enjoyed it. So.
Yeah. And I'm assuming you're going to give us more of an explanation for what's going on, because it's a very strange story.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a whole lot more going on and that was one complaint I had from a few readers. It was like, I want to know more about it. Well, I'm like, well, yeah, you're going to get more story. And, definitely there's a lot more going on there. The Arles, the aliens are going to be revealed a lot more, along with more about, what exactly happened to the twins that were the focus of the story. There's a lot more going on. I'm always hesitant to reveal in advance before I write everything out, because if you tell someone the story before you write it, then you never write it. So
yeah, well, don't do that, because I want to read it when it's so yeah. You have to
jinxing
finish it
bad. Yes.
I'm probably jinxing you now by putting pressure.
But otherwise I do have I've got some other short stories in the mix. I'm actually have a third story set in the universe of Plague Birds that is about a quarter of the way done. And that one actually, the story of Krista Deanne and that universe is one I think I'm going to do a whole series of stories on. There's just so much to the story. There's just so much I want to tell about that universe and about the characters. And every time I come up with a new story idea for it, I'm like, oh, this is great. So I have to write it. So that I think that might be you're going to be seeing. Hopefully people don't get sick of that those stories anytime soon.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. That'd be fantastic. Yeah. Well, was there anything else you wanted everybody to know? Obviously you have your website, which is jasonsanford.com. But any other major projects coming up, or is that pretty much the Sanford docket for the while?
Well, that is next week I'll be at the Context Science Fiction Convention in Columbus, Ohio, and I am giving I'm the moderator for a panel discussion called Is a Science Fiction Renaissance Around the Corner? And that one's I'm really excited about that discussion, because it's got some great science fiction writers. We've got Tobias Buckell, we got Paul Melko, Paul Stevens, who's an editor with Tor. So we have a lot of great people to talk about this subject, and I'm hoping to give a summary of what people say and on my website maybe a week or two after that. And otherwise, that's the only big thing I have in my future besides writing.
I'm now completely envious, because I love both Bacall and Melko. They're both amazing writers.
Oh, yeah, they're wonderful, and it's going to be good. It's good. I'm really looking. I don't think I've ever looked forward to doing a panel like I have this one. So in fact, I'm a little nervous since I'm the one moderating it. I came up with the idea of the panel, so I'm like, okay, just I hope I'm not the one to mess it up.
Welcome to our world.
You can edit that comment out. It's all good. But, and after that, I will be at the World Fantasy Convention, which is coming to Columbus, Ohio, You may have picked up, I live in Columbus, Ohio. I don't
Why does
get out
all the cool stuff happen in Columbus? What's up with that?
Hey, we're just a happening city. What can we say?
All California gets is Comic-Con, so Eden Conference, I suppose. You know, but nothing that I can go to anyway. All right. That sounds fantastic, Jason. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you for interviewing me. If y'all need anything, let me know. And again, thanks a lot.
Sure, no problem. And we'll definitely be keeping in touch over the years, for sure.
And keeping definitely. An eye out for your new stories.
Yes. Hey, great, great. We all take care.
You too.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
Bye. And we're back. We want to say a quick thank you to Jason for agreeing to do the interview and spending quite a bit of time with us. That was really awesome of him. And
yeah, it was amazing. It was a great interview. And
fantastic, yeah.
I felt like I definitely learned something about, well, just short stories in general and writing in general. So
And Sci-Fi Strange.
And Sci-Fi Strange, for sure. Yes.
Which I know great. Adam is looking forward to, by the way. So.
Oh, well, at least we'll have something good for Adam to listen to.
Since he's such a traitor. Anyway, so we don't want to spend too much time babbling, I guess, this time. So we'll just go straight to our question of the week, which Jen has.
Yes. What book were you most pleased to have bought on a whim? So, Duke, what was it?
Old Man's War by John Scalzi. Saw it in a Borders, and I thought the cover was, like, really cool looking, and I was like, all right, I'll buy it. And I loved the book, so I was really happy that I bought that on a whim.
And since then, have you purchased more John Scalzi?
I own almost everything by him, although I haven't read all of his stuff.
Well, there you go. It was a good whim, wasn't it?
Very good whim, especially for him, because he's gotten royalties from me for almost everything.
And I have a similar story. Well, when I was in the United Kingdom, probably, oh, holy crap, 16 years ago, we were desperate for reading materials, and my dad and I walked into a bookstore and found David Gemmell. And I don't remember even what series or what book it was that we first purchased. It was different titles in the United Kingdom, if I remember correctly, than it was over here. And it took another like 3 or 4 years after we came back until David Gemmell was even available in the United States.
Jeez.
And the second that he was, we snagged up almost every single book that David Gemmell had written up to that point and then just kept buying him over the years. It was a great freaking whim. And, you know, he's definitely one of my favorite authors at this point. So.
And now, by the way, you don't have to deal with that ever again because there's the Book Depository, which ships books internationally for free.
Thank goodness. If only that had been in existence 15 years ago.
Yep, yep. They're really
Sadly,
fantastic.
David Gemmell has passed, and so no more David Gemmell, which makes me sad.
Very sad. Anyway, so, and you can send your answers to the question of the week by going to our email, which is skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, or sending a voicemail at 206-203-1686, leaving a comment on our WordPress page, which is skiffyandfanty.wordpress.com, or sending us an at message at Twitter, which is... I'm assuming you know how to use Twitter, as we say every week, but it's twitter.com/skiffyandfanty. So, yeah, those are the ways you can get it, can contact us. We'd love to hear from you. And obviously, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the Jason Sanford interview, since we just did that, and it was awesome. It was fantastic, and I am totally gushing and envious. So, yay!
All right. Thanks again, Jason, and have a good week, everybody.
Yep. Take care. Goodbye.
Bye-bye now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Shush, I get the last word. Now. Bye.
What? How's that even fair?
The thing is it doesn't matter if you said anything after that. I could just cut it.